93% of your life is spent indoors, but so many of our best moments are outdoors. That's why I'm so excited to share with you Outer. Outer makes the world's most beautiful, comfortable, and durable outdoor furniture. When I moved to New York last year and got a new place, one of my priorities was finding an outdoor workspace. Outer's products have provided me with that game-changing experience. I now have outdoor furniture that's durable, that has modular designs. It has life-proof material that withstands the weather and the fluctuations that New York often brings. They have a patented built-in outer shell cover to keep your furniture dry from rain and dew. It's the "how did no one think of this before" product for me on the outdoor furniture front. I've absolutely loved it, and I know you will too. See the difference at liveouter.com/room. And now through May 1st, you'll get $300 off plus free shipping. Again, that's liveouter.com/room and get $300 off plus free shipping. Only available to our podcast listeners. You're going to absolutely love it. Interested in investing in commercial real estate, but not sure where to start? Me too. Well, Lex has created a new way for you to invest in real estate. Lex turns individual buildings into public stocks via IPO, so you can invest, trade, and manage your own portfolio of high-quality commercial real estate. Any U.S. investor can open a Lex account, browse opportunities in various asset classes such as multifamily and office buildings, and buy shares of these individual buildings. Lex opens up direct and tax-advantaged ownership in an asset class that has previously been inaccessible to most investors. Get started today and explore Lex's live assets in New York City and an upcoming IPO in Seattle. Sign up for free at lex-markets.com/room and get a $50 bonus when you deposit at least $500. What is up?
How you doing, man?
Good to see you. Good to see you. I feel like it's been a week or two since we've gotten on one of these, so I'm glad we're back.
Totally.
I've got a list.
Yeah, you got a list?
I've got a list, man. I mean, well, first off, since we last recorded, the world has exploded, you know, in a lot of ways, in a lot of tragic ways, as I'm sure everyone is well aware at this point with everything going on in Ukraine and Russia. And a few things related, you know, on the kind of the more the business side of that, that I was hoping to chat through today. But I had an interesting conversation last night that I want to start with, because I just thought it was like, I don't know, it's kind of random, but it was pretty interesting. I have this close friend who he works right now at McKinsey, and he's really like an entrepreneurial guy. And he, you know, previously founded a business. He probably wants to found another business. He's like deep down the crypto Web3 rabbit hole. And I was asking him, like, dude, why the hell are you at McKinsey? Like, what are you doing? And he was trying to explain the rationale to me of, you know, it's like a high paying W-2 job. And it made me start thinking about, and like the analogy I gave him was, you as a person, I'm curious for your perspectives on this. It's like you as a human being, imagine yourself as like a pile of cash, like $1 million of cash. You're just a pile of cash. And it's not always that you find the like perfect thing to invest that cash in, like to invest your resources in. And so sometimes you need to find the like high yield savings account to store that cash in while you're waiting to find the big opportunity. And so I presented that to him as like, that's what you're doing. McKinsey in this case in your life right now is like the high yield savings account. Like you're getting a return on your money, you're getting your W-2 income, you're getting this like prestige, it looks great on your resume. But as soon as that thing comes along that you know is like a 10X like opportunity on that cash, the cash that is your life, you're gonna like take it out of the high yield savings, wire it into whatever that opportunity is and let it rip and run. And I thought it was such an interesting analogy when I put it together, because I was like, it's really how I think about a lot of different opportunities in life. Like you need your kind of like storage place where you know you're getting yield and you know you're getting a baseline return so that you can wait and have the luxury of waiting for what those big opportunities are, so that you're not just like constantly running between, you know, things that you think might be runaway opportunities. What do you think?
Well, I think people romanticize entrepreneurship in general. So, and I think I see a lot of people who like jump into building when they have no savings and they get into debt. And it's actually, it's quite sad. So I think like it's easy to knock on this like essentially McKinsey bro. But I think it makes sense as long as he's spending his nights and weekends and he's actually like building stuff, launching stuff. Nothing wrong with a high paying job.
Yeah. It's sort of like find your version of that high yield savings account. I mean, it's like, it's great. It's a great insulation sometimes in life, and you can park your cash, like you as an asset there while you wait for what that thing is that grabs your curiosity and gets you so excited to jump into the next thing. It was just something I was thinking about, you know, like in real time last night when I talked to him. So I wanted to bat it around, but let's jump into the list. Yeah. Yeah.
It reminded me of like this concept of mailbox money. You know that concept? Mm-hmm. It's like making money that, you know, basically pays your bills, your like lifestyle. And if you can do that automatically, like it comes in the mail. And I actually set up this affiliate campaign that would provide me, you know, a few thousand dollars every month. And it's been going live for years. And it's actually the thing, the high yield savings account, basically, that allowed me to actually go and build a lot of the products I wanted to go build.
Yeah, so mailbox money is a cool concept. I've talked about that with Ndamukong Su, who we have coming on the show soon, actually. He talks about it a lot in the context of athletes and how mailbox money is so important because they're making this like super high salary, but it really only lasts for a few years. And so deploying that salary into things that generate mailbox money for the rest of your life is, you know, a really good insulation from potential future disruption. I completely agree. It's like, yeah, you know, it gives you the flexibility to go pursue those high upside opportunities because you're not worried about the downside.
Yeah. So there's one way to do it is get a job at McKinsey, high yield savings account. Other way to do it is build some sort of passive income or mostly passive income product that just pays you.
Yeah. The one thing about passive income that a lot of people don't talk about, like passive income has become this meme where like, you know, everyone on TikTok is like, here's how to generate $10,000 of passive income a month, whatever. The thing about passive income that I've found is like, it's never quite as passive as you think. There are very few things that are truly passive. Every now and then, you know, maybe you come across something or you've been very elegant in designing something. But most income, if you want to keep it going, there's like more time involved than you think. And so the other thing I would just caution people against is like, the idea of passive income is almost like a misnomer in and of itself. There's going to be some time and some, at least like headspace allocation that you have to do, that you have to put towards it. So be mindful of it as you continue to build.
Totally.
Dude, we don't have a ton of time and we've got a great guest joining us for part of the discussion. So I want to dive into our lists. I know you've got a couple things. I've got a couple things. You want to just jump right in?
Yeah, let's. You lead us off.
All right. So I've got a few things on my list. I want to start with crypto and Ukraine. And I don't want to wade into the territory of people trying to opine on military strategy or, you know, anything that's happening from a geopolitical context. But the crypto side of this is fascinating to me. And really what I'm referring to is the fact that crypto donations have been accepted by Ukraine and are flowing in insane amounts. Into supporting Ukraine in this battle against Russia. And I think the most recent numbers I saw before we were recording was like something like $60 million of crypto assets had been raised. And like people had donated, someone donated a CryptoPunk. Gavin Wood, the founder of Polkadot, donated like $6 million of crypto. So it's this amazing show of force from the kind of Web3 and crypto community and coming together and supporting this. And it's so counter to the broader narrative of like crypto is for fraudsters, scammers, criminals, you know, degenerates, etc. So I'm curious for your thoughts on it.
Well, I think, and it actually goes back to what we were talking about around passive income and active income, which is people just like to bucket things into one category. It's either active income or it's passive income. It's either for criminals or it's not for criminals.
And everything's black and white.
Everything is black and white. And the reality is that everything lives on a spectrum. So what I think the $50+ million going to Ukraine has taught, you know, a mainstream audience is that the spectrum is now enlarged in a lot of people's brains. Now a lot of people are like, okay, like yes, you can use crypto for bad, but you can also use crypto for good. And I think what this is actually going to do is it's going to inspire a whole set of entrepreneurs, next generation entrepreneurs, who are going to be building crypto products or crypto companies that are social cause based. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's a great point you make. I mean, some of the stuff that's happening is just pretty inspiring, like broadly, just from the outside looking in, like, you know, even not being someone that's super involved in the community. I mean, you had, there is Polkadot founder, which I mentioned, Chain CEO, Deepak Thapliyal, donated like $300K. There's this gaming company, like a Ukrainian gaming company called Holy Water, that launched an NFT gallery from all Ukrainian artists, and I think they had raised like $40K by the time that I was checking it out. There's literally like really amazing things. There was a Russian national actually living in the U.S. who recorded a video burning her Russian passport and was auctioning it off and donating the proceeds to the struggle in Ukraine. So I think it's just this amazing thing of like, you know, innovation kind of coming together with this situation where it's opening up new inroads to supporting people. I've seen people like paying for Airbnbs in Ukraine. I mean, using these different vectors to support people is just a really interesting thing that's happening. I also just think, and I texted you this or texted our group chat this earlier, how crazy it is that I think Vladimir Putin is probably the highest dislike to like ratio in human history. Like if you were to go, you know, there's 7 billion people in the world or whatever the number is. If you were to go ask people like, do you dislike or like him? I think he probably has the highest ratio of dislikes to likes in history, which is like being the most unpopular human being in history is kind of wild.
Yeah, it is wild. I mean, well deservingly, for sure, I think.
Yeah. What about the big tech side of this? That's like the other side that's been in the news a lot is like, how tech companies have responded and how business has responded in general and kind of pulling out of Russia. Like you've seen, you know, Apple announced they were closing operations within Russia. They don't have any Apple stores there, but they were shutting down, you know, sales through any kind of third parties. I think Google was stopping ads. Facebook actually got shut off by Russia because Russia claimed that there was misinformation on the platform, which is rich. You know, and you had TikTok, I think, just announced that they were going to shut down streaming in Russia because there was some law passed by Russia that said like fake news couldn't be disseminated on the platform. So TikTok shut off. There's all this like, you know, reaction from the tech community. The cynic in me says, yeah, well, the ruble, the, you know, Russian currency is basically going to be worthless. And so doing business there actually doesn't make sense. And so you can take the PR win of like, hey, we're not doing business in Russia, when the reality is you didn't really want to be doing it economically. But the optimist in me says it's great that the, you know, that the kind of tech and business community is coming together and rallying against this, you know, against a dictator to go do this. So what do you think?
Well, first of all, I saw today that WeWork CEO is one of the companies that, you know, I'm pulling up the quote, WeWork won't exit Russia where biz does, quote unquote, incredibly well. So, you know, theme of this episode is spectrums. And I think like you're also seeing people go on the other side of the spectrum and they're doubling down, which is, you know,
I hadn't seen that, but I'm pulling it up now. That is crazy. Do you know how many I want to look up how many locations they have, because the same thing happened with McDonald's, which at least as of now, I think it has like 847 restaurants in Russia. And I mean, they're refusing to close them. And I think like that would be a big show, right? I think it's like one of the most popular fast food chains in Russia. But McDonald's is keeping them all open. A lot of them are company owned as well. So they actually have control over them. Pretty crazy.
Yeah. And it's like, it is crazy, you know, it's absolutely bonkers.
I imagine they're going to get enough pressure from the public over the next couple of weeks if this situation continues, that it's going to be a lot more difficult for them to justify that. I mean, WeWork, it's like, man, what are you doing? I like with McDonald's, I'm like almost more sympathetic to it. But I still think they should shut them down and kind of, you know, continue to gather momentum around all of this. But WeWork, that's crazy. I was just pulling it up. It's wild. So what do you have on your list, dude? That was the main stuff I wanted to talk about before we have our guest in.
Okay, so new NFT project. Tai Lopez launches NFT project. Did you see it?
Who is Tai Lopez?
Tai Lopez.
He's like a motivational speaker, right? He's famous. I mean, I know he's famous, but like, yeah. What's he famous for?
You may have just seen Tai Lopez because he used to like, he basically had these ads on YouTube where he would be like, this is my garage and this is my Ferrari and this is my house. and like, let me show you how like you can have this. And he would, he would sell stuff, you know, courses like that. Now, fast forward to today, is I think he runs a company that goes, it's like a PE firm, basically. They go and they buy old brands like Radio Shack, et cetera, and they bring them online.
I think he bought Pier 1 Imports. I think he bought like the e-commerce business of Pier 1.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's, you know, Tai Lopez might be, you know, Vladimir Putin is the most hated man in the world. Tai Lopez might be one of the most hated people on the internet.
Really? And he's also really loved. Like, he also has this, like, massive fan base of people that are obsessed with him, right? He's just polarizing.
He's polarizing. He's very, very polarizing. And I don't know enough about, like, Tai Lopez, if you're listening to this. Like, and I know you follow me on Twitter, so, like, you know, nothing, you know, I don't know enough about the situation to be, like, you're a bad guy or a good guy, but there is that perception around that he's kind of like a schemer.
Well, that's like, dude, I mean, I don't know. I have a pushback to this because I think that is a broad perception that has been created around like online courses, online sales, you know, anyone that's like marketing their skills to like teach you how to do something rather than doing it. There's like this broad-based perception against it, right? It's like Grant Cardone, Tony Robbins, Gary Vee gets shit for that kind of stuff. But like Tai Lopez has 1.5 million subscribers on YouTube. Like, he must be doing something right. And the thesis around buying, you know, dated consumer businesses, modernizing their e-commerce stack and, you know, kind of reviving them is actually like a pretty sound fundamental thesis around business.
Yeah, I think, no comment on Tai Lopez, good guy or bad guy. What I wanted to comment about is his new NFT project. So did you see it?
No, I haven't seen it. Tell me about it. I'm going to pull it up while you're talking.
So it's called Original Garage. And basically what it is you buy an NFT and you get to do things with Tai Lopez. So I'm pulling up a tweet that I saw. It's a, you know, from this guy, Eddie is Kongs. Hey, at Tai Lopez, legit question. Why would I pay 30 to 40,000 to watch a movie with you or 80 to 90,000 for your WhatsApp? Who do you think you are? You definitely have a shady reputation and doing this only adds more fuel to the fire. I respect anyone wanting to add value to NFTs, but this is just not the way. So he got a huge blowback from the crypto community around, you know, why are you selling, you know, these very expensive NFTs to go and hang out with me? And Farouk, who's an amazing follow on Twitter, if you're not already following him, it's just at Farouk. He's the founder of Rug Radio. He's really well known in the crypto community. And he got in a fight with Tai Lopez on Twitter. And here's the tweet. Basically, Farouk was saying, like, was kind of being like, this is very cash grabby. And then Tai Lopez tweeted, but if you buy my NFT, you can come to another one of my pool parties at Farouk. And there's a picture in 2016 of Farouk and Tai Lopez at this party. So a lot of drama in the crypto Twitter space. What do you think?
I have a lot of thoughts here. So I don't know Tai Lopez at all. I think he follows me on Twitter. I get, you know, like there's a lot of general animosity towards like people that have made a lot of money selling courses and, you know, talking on the internet, et cetera. I don't know anything about Tai Lopez. I've never watched any of his videos. That plus there is a lot of animosity in general towards cash grab NFTs, right? Like the NFT boom that happened in the like earlier days of NFTs, you know, like kind of earlier part of 2021, that precipitated a bunch of people to do these. Like there were cash grabs, lots of cash grabs. And I feel like now we're kind of into a place with the NFT landscape where, at least for me, I don't see as many things that I'm like, wow, there's nothing to this. Most of the NFT stuff that at least I'm hearing about or that's like generating buzz, it feels to me is more unique. Like at least has some edge. There's some roadmap. There's some like something interesting about it, or like brands are trying to drive interesting extensions or work on things. It feels more like an idea laboratory to me now than like a cash situation where people are just trying to make money. And so I think this situation is like, it's a collision of two really hot button issues. Like one being, you know, Tai Lopez's perspective, reputation, you know, around like how he's made money and what he's done, which already people have animosity towards, as you pointed out. And then the other being, you know, NFT cash grabs and people perceiving the like collision of these two things is a very, very, you know, it's a combustible situation. And so I can see why this would be a situation that would have that. And I'm like, you know, I'm looking at some of the kind of tweets that have come out against it. Like there's Ox Beans. I don't know if you follow him, 0x_beans. He said, like, he pulled up the code base from it. He said, hilarious. The Tai Lopez NFT immediately siphons out the funds into their team's wallet when you mint, just so they can scam your ETH just a little bit faster. So it seems pretty clear that there was like a lot of pushback and blowback within the NFT and crypto community broadly towards this. And I think, look, sorry, my final thought on this is it behooves the crypto and Web3 community, the like real believers who are going to be here for the next 10, 20, whatever years, to police this kind of stuff internally if they perceive there to be, you know, rug pulls, scams, any bad behavior, because anything that you can do to weed out that behavior and police it is helpful towards building a reputation of, you know, more legitimacy around this over time. And everyone knows there's still this negative reputation around crypto Web3, as we talked about in the context of the Ukraine and Russia donations. So any, like, it's encouraging to me to see the crypto and Web3 community policing things that they perceive to be below bar.
Yeah, and I'm happy you said that. I think, like, you know, one of the things in this NFT collection is, you know, I think the gold pass mints for between 80 and 100 ETH, you know, that's, which is, you know, $100,000+, just for access to this NFT. And, you know, I think that's a lot. And that's exactly why there is a lot of blowback from a lot of these projects. Because, you know, you could buy this thing for $260,000 and then 3 months later, Tai Lopez could be off to the next shiny object. So, we're seeing that a lot right now from, the NFT community, which is high mint prices, are a big faux pas. So interesting to see. We'll see, you know, who knows? Maybe Tai Lopez ends up making this like Gary Vee, like a V Friends, and it ends up being an amazing collection. Or maybe, you know, we come back in 12 months from now and it goes to zero.
Yeah. What's your guess? And you can be honest. I don't know. It'd be great to get Ty on the show someday and ask him these questions directly. But if we don't, that's fine. So give your honest take.
I mean, if 97% of NFT projects go to zero, it's just more likely that this project goes to zero.
Yeah, the base rate is pretty bad. That's true. Yeah. I don't even have a percent. Like, I have no perspective on whether it goes to zero, whether it's valuable. But looking at it, it certainly feels sort of absurd. The flip side is, like, if there are people that want to hang out with him that much, that they're willing to pay that much in US dollars, it's kind of the same thing. I just don't, I mean, like, Warren Buffett auctions off a lunch with Warren Buffett every year. it gets donated. Warren Buffett does not need, you know, a few hundred grand or whatever it costs, but I need to pull it up. I think like, I think a crypto person paid like a couple million dollars to do the lunch with him, 1 year. And it regularly goes for like many hundreds of thousands or into the millions of dollars, to have lunch with Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett, much more fucking impressive than Ty Lopez. No offense, Ty Lopez. It's Warren Buffett. Like, I kind of get it. And Warren Buffett is auctioning it off. But this type of thing generally exists where people, you know, auction off time with themselves in order to go do something. I just think it's typically someone that's like made a ton of money and they're donating the proceeds to charity versus putting it in their pocket.
If I was Ty Lopez, I wouldn't have created such a big collection. I think it's like 8,600 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I would have just focused on like 300 people. Like, his odds of success would have been way higher if he just would have taken the Club CPG model, crypto packaged goods by our buddy Chris Cantino, which basically he minted 300 of them. He created a Telegram group at, you know, he's in there 8, 10, 12, 14 hours a day. He's like the community leader. He's doing all the right things. And now the floor price is like 1269 ETH. He's adding value. That's what I would have done if I was Ty. I just started at 300 and then added as time went on.
Yeah, and if I were, I'd probably flip it and just have all proceeds donated to Ukraine at this point. Like, if he wants to have any hope of reviving this situation, I feel like that's got to be the move at this point. But yeah, I mean, so the Warren Buffett thing, by the way, I just looked it up. The last one sold for $4.567 million. Just in Sun, the crypto, the Tron guy, bought it for $4.6 million, bought a lunch with him. I think he wasn't actually able to attend it in the end. There was some whole thing, but the year before that, it went for like $3.3 million. So there's definitely a massive market for the Warren Buffett charity lunch, but I don't think Ty Lopez is quite on the same level as it. And to me, it looks like a cash grab.
Cool.
You know, it's like the duck test, man. If it it's like, if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. That's kind of how I feel about it. So I'm open to being proven wrong, but I don't think I am. Interested in investing in commercial real estate, but not sure where to start? Me too. Well, Lex has created a new way for you to invest in real estate. Lex turns individual buildings into public stocks via IPO, so you can invest, trade, and manage your own portfolio of high-quality commercial real estate. Any U.S. investor can open a Lex account, browse opportunities in various asset classes such as multifamily and office buildings, and buy shares of these individual buildings. Lex opens up direct and tax-advantaged ownership in an asset class that has previously been inaccessible to most investors. Get started today and explore Lex's live assets in New York City and an upcoming IPO in Seattle. Sign up for free at lex-markets.com/room and get a $50 bonus when you deposit at least $500. 93% of your life is spent indoors, but so many of our best moments are outdoors. That's why I'm so excited to share with you Outer. Outer makes the world's most beautiful, comfortable, and durable outdoor furniture. When I moved to New York last year and got a new place, one of my priorities was finding an outdoor workspace. Outer's products have provided me with that game-changing experience. I now have outdoor furniture that's durable, that has modular designs. It has life-proof material that withstands the weather and the fluctuations that New York often brings. They have a patented built-in outer shell cover to keep your furniture dry from rain and dew. It's the "how did no one think of this before" product for me on the outdoor furniture front. I've absolutely loved it, and I know you will too. See the difference at liveouter.com/room. And now through May 1st, you'll get $300 off plus free shipping. Again, that's liveouter.com/room and get $300 off plus free shipping. Only available to our podcast listeners. You're going to absolutely love it.
I think we have a guest coming up, don't we?
Yeah, so we have, and we'll let him in once he gets on. But I'm super excited to have this discussion because I've been wanting, as you know, and you know, one thing that's been on my list for a while to talk about like future of work, talk about the return to the office, return to work, how different companies are managing it, you know, how the market is going to decide whether fully remote or fully in person or hybrid is the right model and what works best for startups, for big businesses, et cetera. And I couldn't really figure out who the right person was to have the discussion. And then it came to me when I read this Wall Street Journal article about Matt Mullenweg, who I think you know or you've met at some point in the past. But Matt, you know, he was actually the creator of WordPress. So he's like an open source OG, has been around for a while, is like an amazing entrepreneur. And now he's the founder and CEO of Automattic. And the company's, I don't know, it's what, like a multi-billion dollar company today, has grown incredibly. But I recently saw this article that was entitled, "This CEO Lets His Employees Work Whenever They Want from Wherever They Want." And it was like the future of everything section in the Wall Street Journal. And so I just realized this is the guy we have to have on to have a discussion around this.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to chat with him. I met him many, many years ago. So we'll see if he remembers me.
Yeah, he's, I mean, he has an incredible, incredible background. I actually, looking it up, Automattic is actually the company behind WordPress. So it's not like some new iteration. He's continued building off of that open source foundation.
Yeah, I think what I'd love to learn from him is, you know, he's been doing remote since before remote was cool. And I know that he's got a lot of like processes in place for meetings and just running a smooth, you know, operation. So I think a lot of us listening, you know, and I run a remote company and I'm always trying to figure out how can I make it, you know, as fun as possible. And I know that he's done that successfully. So I'm here to learn.
Yeah. It's such a hot button issue right now too, the return to work and how people are thinking about it. Like it definitely feels like this black and white camp of, you know, if you're not back in the office, you know, you're dead. Like I saw Keith Raboy, you know, the Founders Fund and, you know, amazing entrepreneur, investor, tweeted out this morning, you know, in response to a tweet saying that someone tweeted, "Startups that buck the trend and commit to in-person are more likely to hire great young talent. I'm seeing talented young engineers say they are, quote, done with remote." And Keith responded, "True." Replied back to in his typical punchy fashion that he operates on Twitter. So I thought that was an interesting backstory to it too.
Yeah, amazing. First of all, amazing response. Oh, what's up, Matt?
Hi, Matt. Welcome. What's going on?
I'm doing pretty well. Thank you so much for having me today.
Where are you? Where are you joining us from?
Actually, Houston, Texas.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. So you haven't hit quite the like swampy summer months yet within Houston.
No, it's chilly, rainy, and cold.
But I love it. Man. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for making a few minutes of time. I know you're busy and have a ton going on, and the world is in a lot of flux right now. So really appreciate it. You know, this is super casual. We don't consider this an interview show by any means. We really just like to have amazing people like yourself come on and join us to jam on interesting things. And so one of the things we've been talking about a lot has been the future of work, right? Like what happens upon this like reopening of the world that it feels like we've been talking about now for 2 years, by the way, and finally maybe now we're starting to get to it. But I first came across you in this Wall Street Journal article that you're probably been sent a million times that was talking about your perspectives on where the world is going. And it was talking about how you let your employees work asynchronously from wherever they are in the world. Can you just start maybe by giving us like a little bit of background on where that ethos came from? Like Greg pointed it out, you've been doing remote since, you know, way before remote was cool and in vogue. So we'd just love to get your perspectives on like where that ethos came from and how it's kind of played through the Automattic story.
Yeah, sure. So the company I'm a CEO of is called Automattic, but Automattic was born out of an open source project called WordPress that lives at wordpress.org. It's all volunteers. And like many open source projects, it was developed online from people all over the world. So myself and the co-founder had never met in person. He was in the UK. I was in Houston, Texas, where I am today. And that was actually not new for open source. If you look at the Linux kernel or Mozilla or all these sorts of things, they were typically communities of passion that came together from everywhere. So although that was new for companies, and we got a lot of pushback once I started a company in 2005, 2003, when WordPress started, open source had been doing this for 15, 20 years. So it felt very natural.
Yeah, it's sort of like the, you know, when people point out the like evolution of the internet and everyone talks about Web 3 now, it's kind of like what's new is also old, because, you know, like the Web 1 ethos of all the open source protocols that were developed mm-hmm. is very much the ethos of what we're talking about today. It's just there's new, you know, adaptations of it in this new world. So it feels like this is kind of the natural extension of that as you talk about it.
I think
Matt,
so.
Did you ever have a stint in San Francisco? Was there ever a point where you moved the company to San Francisco? Because I do remember a presence, a big automatic presence, like on the bay somewhere.
Yeah. So for my story, I had gone to University of Houston for 2 years, and then a company called CNET paid me to drop out, move to San Francisco in 2004. So this is about a year, year and a half after WordPress started, but about a year before I would found the company. And definitely, you know, part of founding the company was going out there. It was amazing for me to meet people and be influenced. And like, San Francisco is definitely where my tribe was, you know, people who are passionate about building the web, passionate about technology. So I still love San Francisco. Like, I think I'm the last one that like I spend time there. My mom's out there right now. Like I actually really love San Francisco. So, and we at first had like a desk in our investor's office. So True Ventures had a spot on Pier 38. You know, Instagram was upstairs. It was a fun spot. And then later that expanded, an office next door came available. So we had it, but it was always like a lounge. Like we've never actually ever done permanent desk or places, but we did want a place for people to get together and to host community events and to do WordPress meetups. And so like, I'm a big believer in in-person and physical space. A big part of Automatic culture is actually meetups, where we would bring either the whole company or teams together a few times a year. But it just felt like the best, most talent in the world was not in San Francisco, regardless of all the smart people I was meeting. It felt like a very small pond to fish in. So if we were trying to compete with the Googles and Facebooks of the world, like we had to fish in the ocean, not the same pond they were fishing in. So by redefining the game, particularly in hiring talent, it allowed us to flourish, even though we had much less funding and, you know, typically made a lot less money than these other companies, especially in the early days.
How do you think about scaling the kind of serendipity that comes from being in a location? You know, mm-hmm. and I say that in the context of San Francisco, because I think part of the, you know, the glory days of San Francisco, if you will, there was this amazing vibe of serendipity where mm-hmm. you could walk out on the street and you'd run into the person that you ended up co-founding your next business with, because there was just this like incredible entrepreneurial vibe, energy. I was at Stanford, and mm-hmm. I was kind of in school during those years. And, you know, even after, when I started working, going to the gym, like you just run into these amazing entrepreneurs, yeah. you know, investors, founders, etc. How do you do that? Like, where is the serendipity in this more remote or hybrid world? How do we find that?
Twitter. You know, like, you know, the exchange of ideas. Now, there is something to be said for like your kids going to school with someone else, or like that is cool. But I think for the like exchange and debate of ideas, that moved online 10, 15 years ago, you know, because through blogging at first, and then microblogging with Twitter and like all these other things, like that was where the ideas were shared and debated and everything, and where the fun was. And so now, like, even like I'll go to dinner in San Francisco and people are talking about the essay they read online. They're not talking about what, you know, Mark Andreessen said to them at the gym. They're talking about the thing he posted or the new article everyone's talking about, or the latest newsletter. That's what's, I think, pretty exciting about it. The latest podcast, like we're on right now, you know, that you don't have to be in San Francisco to listen to this.
I do have a confession to make. So many years ago, I met you actually at a jazz show.
Oh, cool.
So I met
you in SF.
So I was living in Montreal at the time, and you were there for the jazz festival, I presume.
Totally. Yeah.
And I met you, and it was like the first time, what you were one of the first people that I, you were like, I was, you know, I live in San Francisco. I work on this thing called WordPress. I knew about it. And that serendipity actually happened. And actually what ended up happening is you, I think you might've introduced us to someone on our team, on your team. We ended up doing, we ran an agency and we did, we helped some companies actually move from their custom CMSs at the time to WordPress.
Awesome.
And one of those projects was TechCrunch redesign. I don't know if you remember that project. And we worked on it. And that actually is what put our agency on the map, which helped put me on the map, helped like steamroll my whole life.
That's awesome.
So the, yeah.
What a cool thing.
Yeah. So well, like, so I believe in the serendipity of the internet, and I also believe in the serendipity of like in person. Like, what are the odds? You know, it's all about, I think, and you know, I'd love your reaction to this. It's all about like increasing your probability of, you know, these encounters to happen. And these encounters can happen in San Francisco today or a jazz show in Montreal, but could also happen on the internet. So, you know, it, what advice do you have for people who want to increase serendipity?
Say yes. Go to parties, go to events, go to conferences, go to jazz festivals. You know, I actually used to spend every summer in Montreal because it was an amazing city. You know, still is, I think. And they had the jazz festival Just for Laughs, the something Folie. I think there was like a French festival. It was just an amazing city to be in. So I'd always rent an apartment there for like a month in the summer. But we also, you know, a big part of the WordPress ethos is something called WordCamps, which are community organized. So that was also a reason I went to Montreal. So inspired by Barcamp, which I was kind of a co-founding associate of, we said, hey, here's a template for running an event. Do it wherever you want. Just follow these rules, make it free or cheap. And there's been hundreds and hundreds of these in cities around the world. And I actually, early on, I used to go to every single one because I was like, if someone's going to do a conference about WordPress, I'm getting on a plane and going there. So I fly hundreds of thousands of miles per year, go to every single one. And that was part of bootstrapping our community. So that's, I think you can, you know, like fortune favors the prepared. Serendipity favors folks who are out there and meeting folks outside of your normal circle. You just have to balance that, I think, also with, you know, deepening the relationships with the people you care most about. And that was probably what I didn't do as well in my 20s in particular, is because I was always on a plane, you know? And so when I'd go back to San Francisco, my friends would be like, oh, you're in town? Sorry, we didn't know.
I write about this a lot. I actually recently wrote a piece about how to, I call it expanding your luck surface area, or like expanding your serendipity surface area.
I love that.
Like, you can actually, I kind of think there's two types of luck. There's like the very pure and raw form of luck, which is things you truly cannot control. You know, where you're born, who you're born to, the kind of like baseline level of circumstances that you are given, which is totally out of your control. And then there's this more like amorphous, fluid, impure form of luck, which is really the result of these like thousands of daily micro actions that result in this macro thing that we call luck. And I think about it in the context of, have you ever seen Interstellar?
Yeah.
Have you guys seen that movie, the Matthew McConaughey movie? And so in that movie, there's this scene where they're talking about that tiny little planet that was next to the black hole, and how they're talking about the lack of life on that planet. And there was a concept that they talk about, which is basically that it's very low likelihood that a planet right next to a black hole can have life. And it's because the black hole sucks up all of the lucky events that could have struck the planet and been the seeds of life, like the random collisions, the chaos theory, the asteroid that has a seed of life on it, etc. The black hole just sucks all that up. And I think about that a lot in the context of my own life, because so much to me of getting lucky is just getting rid of the black holes that are in your life, like negative people or, you know, pessimists who are around you, like all of those black holes that are kind of the anti-luck. And then also just expanding your own surface area, like opening up your aperture so that all of those lucky things can strike. And to your point, Matt, like saying yes to things, saying yes to everything in your 20s is a great way to do that. You can't get lucky watching Netflix on the couch at home. You can if you go out and you meet people, or even if you're in a Discord and you're engaging with people in good faith, you can get lucky doing that. And so it's like deliberately taking actions that expand, open the aperture, expand your serendipity surface area, feels like the path to going and kind of making your own luck, as it were.
I love that. I'll have to check out that essay. And how cool that that's an essay. And I think even of people that we now think of at the very top of their game, use online to connect with others. You know, like, it's kind of funny. When I first moved to San Francisco, I was introduced to Mark Andreessen to invest in Automatic. But at the time, this was before he had written his amazing blog post. He hadn't really, like, had his blog. And so I viewed him totally wrongly as more like an internet 1.0 guy who was like, didn't really know what was going on. By the way, I was totally wrong. And later, once he started publishing, I was like, wow, this person is a genius. You know, like, what would Andreessen Horowitz be without Mark's seminal essays and Ben's amazing books and essays? You know, like, their writing is part of how they disrupted the VC model and became Andreessen Horowitz, which now we take for granted. Remember that they were like newcomers to the scene.
It is a great point. You know, writing in public, sharing in public, sharing your ideas and insights is such a powerful way to go, you know, attract growth and luck in these opportunities. Because if I'm sitting, like I'm sitting here recording this from my house in New York, in the New York area, I kind of like my reach physically is very small. It's like this room, right? But with the internet, my reach is literally global. And if I put ideas out there, even when I, you know, when I started sharing on the internet, I had zero followers and I just started sharing, and you kind of develop it consistently. It starts growing. You're like casting this net of magnets out into the world that, you know, with your ideas, with your insights, with whatever you're sharing, that really can attract millions, you know, billions of people at scale, who can come and find your ideas, be attracted to them, maybe be repelled by them and push the other way. But you're really casting out into the universe in a much more kind of vigorous and broad way than was ever possible in history.
The best hours I have spent in my entire career are those writing and publishing. Yeah. And I'll pitch WordPress here too. Have your own site.
Yeah,
you know, please. If it's a Medium essay or something like that, people just remember that was on Medium. They don't remember your design, your name, your everything. So it's really nice to have a differentiated presence online.
Yeah, right before this, we were talking about Keith Raboy had this tweet, or he was just talking about how, what was it, Sahil? Like,
basically, someone had tweeted, you know, that startups were starting to buck the trend and commit to more in-person, and that there were like a lot of talented young engineers who were saying they were done with remote. And Keith responded saying he thought that was true. And so Greg and I were chatting about that, kind of having a debate about it. Like, is it true that young people are going to buck the trend of remote? You know, and why? Like, is that going to happen or not?
And my pushback to that whole like energy is, the core assumption there is that it's very, first of all, it's a very US centric point of view. So not everyone has the ability to apply for a job, move to San Francisco, go work in Miami. You know, we have a lot of listeners in India and Nigeria and Kenya. These huge opportunities aren't just as readily available to walk into these doors and apply and start working. So I think writing is such a great way just to attract opportunity.
And just building, right? I mean, for engineers, your code is your code and it's a universal language. Mm-hmm. And if you're building and developing amazing things, you will find amazing opportunities in this era. I think it's fundamentally changed, right? It used to be, very much the case that talent was evenly distributed, but opportunity was not. Mm-hmm. I think we're slowly moving towards a world, and we're not there by any means, but we're slowly moving towards a world where opportunity is evenly distributed. And that if you're a kid born on the street in India, but you have the internet and you teach yourself to code or to develop or write, you'll have as many opportunities as a kid, you know, born in Greenwich, Connecticut, that goes to private school and gets into Harvard. And I think that's a noble mission that we should all, you know, be in favor of, you know, a world where everyone has kind of equality of opportunity. Where, you know, I'm a capitalist, and so I am mm-hmm. all for unequal outcomes, because I think that, you know, performance and doing well, like, you should be rewarded for outsized performance, but equal opportunity with unequal outcomes.
And I think companies need to evolve to take advantage of that new global landscape. So something we didn't do when we started, but we switched in like 2012, 2013, was paying the same salaries regardless of geography, right? It's the same work. It's the same job. You're creating the same value for the company and the customers. So you should make the same pay. Guess what?
That's an amazing innovation, actually. There was I don't know if you saw this, Matt. There was an article in The Atlantic maybe like 2-3 weeks ago that was all about tech companies trying to do the geographic discrimination on pay, you know, mm-hmm. Someone in San Francisco would move to Nashville or move to Boise, and the companies would cut their pay. And that was like the original assumption of big tech mm-hmm. post right when COVID happened. And then I think a lot of them got a ton of pushback to it. Now they're adapting to it by saying, like, you're not going to get the same pay increases. So you're not going to get cut mm-hmm. down, but you're going to have less opportunity to accelerate and grow, because there's going to be like pay bands based on where you live. And I agree with you. I just feel like it's a very myopic view of the world and of kind of how we're developing as a society.
Great. I hope they do that so we can hire more people. But also think about it, that if you're like, let's say you're hiring out of India as an example, if you're going to pay the global rate, you're going to get the very best people, the most connected, et cetera, in that country. Maybe if Keith's company is not, he's not going to get the best person out of those countries. Yeah. And I think in the war for talent, it's not about in office is the future or distributed is the future or anything. I think it's about giving people the choice and the autonomy. So at Automatic, you can work wherever you want in the world, or you can work in San Francisco too. If you love that environment, go. Great. By all means, move to San Francisco. If you want to work from home, great. If you want to go to an office, guess what? We have a co-working stipend. We'll give you $250 per person per month to go to a WeWork or a coffee shop or wherever you want to go. So you can be around that energy. You can go to Miami and be at the same co-working space as Keith's companies if you want. Like, that's fine. So it's just about giving that choice. And that's where I think people really thrive, because some people do want to be in an office environment. Great. They can work for Automatic and be in an office environment. We allow people in the same cities to pool together. So again, pre-COVID, people in the same city would often like get together once a week or something, have lunch. That's all things the company can support. It's not like you have to choose one way or another and that you're wedded to that forever. You just have to listen to your people. What do they want?
The cool thing about a lot of this too, which you pointed out, is the market will decide. Right? There are going to be companies that do this. There are going to be companies that say, no, you have to be back in the office 5 days a week and work, you know, synchronously and the old way, you know, the kind of industrial era style of work. And then there are going to be companies that, like Automatic, you know, take a much more forward thinking perspective on it, and the market will decide, you know, that the best talent will flow to the places where they want to work, where the environment is what they want to work in. And the companies will either do really well or they won't. And we'll know, you know, in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, we'll know what the future of work looks like, because the market will determine it in a lot of ways. You know, talent can vote with their feet, mm-hmm. as it were, which is a really cool thing, I think.
By the way, we're talking about companies like their monoliths, but it could also be within teams or divisions within a company. You know, we're 2,000 people now. We hired 700 last year, by the way, so you can scale this quite a bit. If a team wanted to be in person or get an office, I'm fine with that. That's an experiment we could run. And maybe it could sort out. Maybe there's already 10 people living in a city and they want to go into an office every day. Sure, they can try that. If that's what they want to do. I'm not like religious about these things. It's about getting the work done and serving customers. It's not about how we got it done.
How do you think about time zones and time zone working? A lot of people have teams where they'll have, you know, some people in Europe, some people in East Coast, West Coast. I know some companies like Shopify will basically create teams remote, but in certain time zones. So you know, only EST, PST, but they don't care where you live. How do you think about time zones and synchronous versus async?
I think for teams, it's good to be in a range. I'm actually okay with a range of up to 7 or 8 hours. So like Europe and US is okay, because you can still overlap for an hour or two a day, and that's usually plenty. if you need a lot more, you're probably having too many meetings. But we did make the mistake and no longer put teams that are spread across, you know, kind of like Asia Pacific, Americas, and European time zones, because that's just bad for everyone. But I think it's great for a company to have that, because by the way, that makes 24/7 coverage way easier for things like support or anything, you know, systems or anything you need responsiveness and 24/7 coverage of, which every business at scale does for certain things. It's fantastic to be international. It's been actually, for example, we acquired a company called Tumblr that was primarily in the New York and actually Richmond region. And a big thing we've been doing is trying to increase the responsiveness of their support by hiring more folks internationally. They would develop much bigger queues on weekends and outside of the U.S. East Coast time zones hours. And so that also meant that bad guys would start to take advantage of the Eastern hours. You know, they knew that there would be longer response times if they did things in the middle of the night in New York.
Can you talk about Tumblr for a second? I was like a Tumblr kid. So when I saw that you all bought them, I was just excited to see that, you know, some TLC was going to be put to that platform. So I'm just curious, is there anything you can share around why you bought Tumblr and maybe some plans of where you're taking it?
Well, one, Tumblr is really cool. It's social blogging done right. So it's got the best of a social network and the best of blogging. It is majority, so 55% under 24 and under. So it's a young blogging network, which is neat. It's different than WordPress's demographics. It's primarily mobile, 85% on mobile. It's still doing tens of thousands of signups per day, very active. And it's actually the queerest social network. It's about at least a quarter LGBT plus. So it's a really fun creative space for art and artists. And we took it to turn it around. And actually, you know, some news as of February 1st, I'm running it personally. So I'm day-to-day running Tumblr as CEO, working on the product, working on the design, working on the tech, working on everything. And so hopefully we can accelerate the pace of iteration and be something. If you haven't used it in a while, I strongly encourage you to check it out, reinstall it, and try it out again. It still has a purely chronological feed, so we need to make that an onboarding experience better. But when you get your feed dialed in, it's one of the funnest places on the internet.
So before we let you go, Matt, I'm curious to just get your perspective. You know, the CEO of a massive, you know, multi-billion-dollar company now, which you've grown super fast from a team perspective, but you're not a loud, showy, you know, jump up on stage, pound your chest type guy.
You at haven't least been to karaoke initial... with me.
That's true. I'd love to go to karaoke with you, actually. We'll do that sometime. I will come visit Houston. We'll do that. I've actually been to a great karaoke place in Houston that I'll send you.
Wow.
But you don't strike me as that type. Can you just give us a couple of like your kind of realizations or lessons on leadership that have allowed you think, to be successful, or what you've learned along the way, maybe that you've changed your mind on as it comes to leadership?
Yeah, I know we're at time, but I guess the main thing is that I am not like the rah-rah run around on stage CEO. And I used to really try to change myself to be, and it just didn't feel natural, didn't feel authentic. But that's the whole point of an executive team, is you can hire people who are great at the things that you're not. So as you grow your team, your company, you know, I've explicitly looked for folks who are maybe a bit more outgoing in that way, or a bit more like certain in how they talk about things, where I might be like a little more soft-spoken or nuanced or academic sometimes in my speech. So yeah, Just look for that. And just, but do you.
It's a great realization.
So when I tried to change, it wasn't as good.
It's a great one.
Yeah. And I apologize. That's I got to run.
Well, thank you
I
so much.
I got a meeting.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it.
Thank you so
much. Thank you so much for joining us. Join our free community at trwih.com.